Talk given Sunday, 17th April, 1977. Everyone in the world, without exception, has longings. He has longings which perhaps change as regards the object of those longings throughout his life. And these longings are powerful desires in us. The world as a whole has obviously worldly longings. First and foremost, to enjoy oneself, to have a full share of sensational delights. Then there are ambitions to become this, that, or the other, to achieve this, that, or the other. There is the desire, the longing for security, the longing to be accepted in society, either in terms of his egoistic domination over others, or in terms which are somewhat milder, and to be accepted by those whom he considers his betters or superiors. And so on, there are innumerable worldly longings. But those of us who become seriously interested in religion, in the sense of living the full, the true religious life, come across this teaching that we must be free of all desires for ourselves, as usually interpreted by the religious person. So there emerges a conflict within himself, because no living person can escape the fact that desires for oneself are part and parcel of one's psychical constitution. They are the dynamic energy, if you like, which moves them to action. And when one comes across a teaching to transcend all desire, all longings, inevitably a conflict is set up. In the early stages, this conflict gives rise inevitably to the practice of suppressing, repressing his desires. This is a profound error. It leads only to the illness of the whole psychophysical organism and makes the person unfit for living the truly religious life. The pleasure drive is the drive which is uppermost, both consciously and unconsciously, in all human beings. We have to see that fact as a fact and fully acknowledge it. If we fail to see the fact completely and wholly to acknowledge that that is the fact about oneself, if we fail to do that, we shall never be able to live the religious life in the true sense. Consider, if a person suffers from an illness, and you know how many hundreds of people do this, and because he is rather proud of his strength, his capacity to deal with it, he just says to himself or to others who want to commiserate with him, "Oh, nothing at all, it's nothing at all." And he neglects to do the right thing by the fact that he is ill in this, that, or the other way. And the end result, of course, could be, often is, disaster. Now, it's identically the same with respect to our psychological processes, to our psychical life. If we don't see the fact as the fact, we shall fail in letting the psyche grow to maturity, to the state of complete health, wholeness, holiness. So we have to acknowledge the fact that the pleasure drive is there. Now, when we take to the religious life, and if a person is intelligent enough to be, to some extent at least, free of this conflict where pleasure is concerned, he thinks he is free, of the pleasure drive, when all that he does is to substitute longings which are of a religious nature in place of longings which are of a worldly nature. But we don't see this. It is extremely difficult to see that all longings, all desires, good, bad, indifferent, according to our ordinary, ambivalent, worldly standards, they are all desires, they are all longings, which are necessarily related to oneself. Supposing one is in that state where he says that he is utterly devoted to the service of God only. He doesn't care what happens to himself. And yet, this complete devotion is of such a nature that, in actuality, the man is seeking the satisfaction of the of this desire to be devoted to the service of God, the Supreme, or be devoted to the realization of the Atma, as he might say, or discover the truth, and so forth. So long as there is that self-consciousness by means of which the I, the person, the subject, enters into the field of his life process, there is always myself and all the rest at play. So his longing for what ordinarily we might call a very exalted idea, a very exalted condition to be realized, that longing is just as much self-centered, self-concerned, as the longing of the worldly man for happiness, for success, for security, and so on. This is a point which we fail to see. It is extremely difficult to see it fully if one reads about it or hears somebody speak about it. The intellect, this top layer of brain cells only, says yes. Perhaps says yes. Yes, that's quite true. But that truth has not penetrated inside at all. Because one goes on living more or less in the same old way, bending one's energies towards the satisfaction of one's longings, however sublime, however exalted, however refined, subtilized, divinized they may be. But this divinizing is all in terms of one's own concepts. And are my concepts, the concepts of the separate individual person, the imperfect individual person, are my concepts a measure to be applied to that which is the immeasurable? Are my concepts of any value in relationship to the inconceivable, the unimaginable? Because words like Brahman, Godhead, or God, God too also, Atma, the infinite, the absolute, words like that, in actual fact, completely deny everything that we are as in our present condition and that we know in our mode of knowing, and that which is knowable by us. This is something we don't see. You see, we present a frame and we want the absolute or the supreme or the ultimate to fit in as a agreeable picture in that frame. Agreeable to me, the self-centered person. A person may argue, but good gracious, I have given up everything for the sake of the worship of God or the realization of the Buddha nature or kingdom of heaven or anything you like. These are words. They are spoken sincerely. We need not challenge the sincerity of the person. what we need to challenge, what we need to look into, and really understand and really see, is what is the real value of these, of this given up everything for the sake of the Supreme. The very form in which it is presented, I have given up everything for the sake of the ultimate reality, the truth, the Supreme. Those very words signify that I want the Supreme, the truth. Why have I given up? In order to buy the Supreme. Why do I live the wholly virtuous life, assuming that I can, under such conditions? Why do I live the wholly virtuous life? In order to gain the kingdom of heaven, or nirvana, or whatever it is. You see, the extraordinary subtlety and the amazing power of this isolative self-consciousness that rules us. It is extremely difficult to see these things. We see them superficially, yes. But we don't see them wholly. If we saw the truth wholly, there'd be no more conflict. There'd be no more striving for realization. There'd be no more a knowing that one had realized, if realization were there. For instance, to take a faint analogy, when the body is perfectly well and strong and healthy, one just doesn't waste one's time consciously thinking, the body is well and strong and healthy. It just is so. It's taken for granted. And if anybody sort of says, how well you look and are and so forth, a person might feel, so what? What is there to talk about? What is there to know about it? It is so. Of course. In that sense of course-ness, there is the real unself-conscious being healthy and well, instead of knowing that I am well and healthy. The moment the knowing element enters, there is a dichotomy. Because in our form of knowing by means of the brain is one which separates out that which is known, the object known, from the subject who knows. So I am separate from my wellness and healthiness if I know that I'm well and healthy. When you are the whole thing, you don't know it. Therefore, if one sees this in relation to what we call our profoundly religious longings and aspirations, then If we really see that, we become unaware that we have any religious aspirations. They just are there. And they just function naturally. They are part of the total universal process. A creatively active part of the total universal process. The really Holy One has no time, no use for knowing that He is the Holy One. We may ask, well, that all sounds very nice philosophically. But what is the consequence of being in that state? Consider, is not most of our energy misdirected? And it is misdirected fundamentally because we seek for ourselves. For instance, you know how in Christian teaching the words are attributed to Jesus, knock and it shall be opened unto you, seek and ye shall find, and so forth. In what context do they really apply? Don't they really apply in the limited context of emerging out of a more imprisoned state into a less imprisoned state? Seek and you shall find. But if the Supreme Reality is an omnipresent reality, and all the religions present that teaching of the omnipresence of the Supreme, called the Supreme God or the Infinite or the Absolute or any word you like. If it is an omnipresent reality, what is the meaning of seeking for it? How can you seek that which is everlastingly present here? You seek something finite, something particular. But if this is the infinite, the totality, the absolute, how can you seek it? Can you seek for space? That's the best example one can give, because everyone knows, everyone experiences the reality of space. Can you seek space? You can't escape space at all. It's everlastingly here. So one is free of greed for space. Occasionally a curious creature like Hitler comes along and uses the word Lebensraum, living room, as if there was the slightest absence of living room. It is like that. Now let us look at it this way. In seeking that which does not need to be sought, are we not misdirecting our energies? And in actual fact, we are preventing the real fruition of our individual being and the fruition of the purpose of our existence. So, this tendency to misdirect our energies just naturally fades away if we see this fact. If we are capable of seeing the fact fully and wholly, we are already completely and truly human, completely and truly pure and clean, intelligent, loving, good, and all the rest of it, quite naturally and spontaneously. What is it, then, that we can do? Because we are all aware that the very fact that we are full of longings of this sort implies that there is something which is wanting, something lacking, something imperfect. Now it is that imperfection that we can really see. We can't see the infinite, we can't see God, or taste or touch or think and so forth. But we can see just what we are at this moment. And deal with it. We can see that we are attached to this and we are averse from that. Therefore, we are constantly functioning in this ambivalent state, this state of conflict. We are unable to live wholly. That doesn't mean not do anything about that which is obviously wrong or evil, etc. If we really saw this clearly, then we would direct our energies in the right way to dealing with that which is not right. And you will ask, what is the right way? Well, obviously, to fight against the evil is not a right way. To try to destroy the evil is not a right way. The whole world's history, from the beginning of time, shows that in attempting to overcome an evil, we sow the seeds of other evils, sometimes even greater evils and more evils. Why is this? How does it come about? A thing is evil, and we see it as evil in our way. You ask a man who participates as a guerrilla for the liberation of his country. See what he does, what he has to do. The ruthlessness, the murder, and so on. All in the name of bringing about peace, goodwill, happy relationships, by cutting the other fellow's throat. The business world has done that through the ages. Not the whole of the business world, but a good deal of it. Laissez-faire and all that sort of thing. See? So, our method of dealing with the evil is still an extremely limited, unintelligent way of dealing with it. We have to see this. It isn't at all easy. We are, in fact, reacting against that which we disapprove of. We disapprove of evil. It is essentially and fundamentally right to see evil as evil. But is it intelligent or practical in the true sense to disapprove of it? What is we can regard the evil situation in this way. Everything is the resultant of so many forces at play. This is a universal fact. One of the big meanings of the word karma. Anything is the resultant of so many forces at play. None of these forces is static. None of these forces is changeless in nature or in extent. No result is a fixed result. It itself is continuously changing. This is the great karmic process. Now, if I disapprove of this result and try to fight against it or destroy it, I'm trying to do something which is really impossible to do. I don't take into account the fact that everything only undergoes change. Nothing can be annihilated. The totality remains a totality. A totality in which nothing is fixed and changeless. Do you remember that? But certain patterns which emerge in the process of change throughout the universe, certain patterns are harmonious patterns. They represent the fulfillment, the fruition of the forces at play. You are all fond of flowers and gardens and so forth. Well, if one does the right thing by the soil, the seed, and the plant, when it grows up, it comes to fruition. There is beauty, there is fulfillment. But you and I know that, of course, in that process there is the birth of the plant, the emergence, its growth, its decay, its passing away, and so forth. And we take it all in our stride in the right way. Of course, if it's an oak tree, the oak tree will survive us and several generations to come. But that's another matter. But because we do the right thing in this situation, with this particular pattern, it comes to fruition, to fulfillment. It changes all the time. Similarly, that which we call good, or that which we call evil, is also a changing pattern, a continuously changing pattern. How shall we deal with it? Obviously not in terms of destruction or the attempt to annihilate it. We can change it for the better. we can transform it. That is a continuous transformation process going on. And it goes on not only because of our existence on this planet as individuals, not only because of that, but also despite our existence. Consider how much wrong we do, the way we exploit the earth. The earth just goes on, you know. It suffers a great deal. Then after a time, there comes some sort of cataclysm. Because we have done the wrong thing by the earth. But it goes on. The earth goes on and life goes on despite us. And life goes on fruitfully, happily, also because of those human beings who understand and are intelligent and direct their energies towards cooperating with the modes of change which bring everything to fruition. This is something we must see very, very clearly. Now, where living the religious life is concerned, what we are trying to do is to help the living organism, which is not a tree or a mosquito or a lion or something, but is a human being, so-called, we are trying to bring the human being to fulfillment, to fruition, by trying to live the religious life. And that human being always has to be just oneself. One can't bring another person to that particular fruition. Because that fruition involves one's own individual awareness, his mode of awareness of totality, of existence, of his relationships with all other human beings, with things, and with the world process as it goes on. So, it is a case of the transformation of consciousness itself. And this implies the transformation of the psyche. But, one may ask, does not this involve knowing the goal? No, it doesn't. This is where we make a great mistake. The philosophies of the world, the theologies of the world, have presented a whole set of concepts and ideas and techniques to fulfill those ideas. Yes, you can fulfill the ideas, and you will discover at the end, or perhaps, if you're fortunate, well before the end, that this isn't quite the thing. We have developed, we have progressed, we have reached the sky. And we thought that God was just hiding behind the sky, and he's not there. You see, we pursue our concepts. And as I said a little earlier, our concepts are no measuring rod for the inconceivable, the totality. Let be. Live by letting live. What we can do is to see just what our particular reactions are at the moment. At every single moment, the particular reactions which the brain throws out to the totality of our everyday experience. This is the thing to watch. The Buddha put it in these terms, samasati, perfect mindfulness, and samasamadhi, the perfect communion. Concentration is a limiting word in this context. Perfect communion. That means being completely awake to everyone, to everything which comprises the situation in which we are placed, including ourselves. Jesus said, watch and pray. And he didn't mean watch the course of events in Central Australia or by the Amazon River or in Uganda or anywhere else. Or Oxford Circus, if you like. Watch here, the traffic here, inside the brain. Pure mindfulness. This which reacts to every living stimulus that keeps coming to us. It reacts. It does not respond. And it never can respond. These are things we must clearly understand. The brain, which is the concretest expression of universal mind, is purely an instrument of observation. This can never be repeated too often. It is a computer, it is a recorder, and so forth. It is indispensable because, being the concretest expression of mind, it is the apparatus through which mind can function in the living organism called the man. That's all that the brain is. It is the brain which holds, in terms of memory, conscious memory, as well as subconscious memory, and in terms of actual impression on all the brain cells, a photographic and chemical impression of what happens to us throughout our life, as the impressions reach us through our senses. Therefore it holds the past. But it holds the past not purely in its factual state, exactly as it was and as it happened, but it holds it all bedeviled by the interpretation that the brain gives to every event. Now this interpretive activity of the brain is the obstructor for pure knowledge of the fact as the fact. From childhood onwards, something happens. Then mama says, or papa says, look at that, etc., and puts taboos upon this, and encourages that. Look how papa encourages the little fellow when he's fisticuffing with his neighbor's son to biff him one, laddie. That's right, good. Well done, you've won. What happens? What happens? You see how the psyche is twisted and distorted. Where is love, beauty, goodness, truth, intelligence, perfection, right action? But throughout life this happens. And you see, when the little child sees something and inquires, "Ah, what is that?" And somebody explains, "Oh, that is so and so," and also gives a meaning to it. And a meaning which involves certain values. I will lose this, or I will gain that, or a little bit of both. I'll have pleasure out of this, or pain out of it, etc. Ah, you like it? I want more of it. Have more of it. Have a little more. Ah, my ego is very satisfied when I give the little nipper a little more of it and see him gulping it down in the most ungentlemanly or unladylike manner. And so forth and so forth. You see how the whole process produces a false set of values, a considerably mistaken interpretive activity in the growing creature. And this goes right through our lives. Is it surprising that nations are at war with each other? That families are disunited? And so on, endlessly. Then we try to settle problems by getting together, as we say, and discussing, trying to see the whole situation. What do we try to do in actual fact? Do we really try to see the whole situation, or are we playing a game with the other person, trying to get the best out of him to satisfy all our own personal longings? Our own egoism, our vanity, our power lust, and so on and so on. So you see, the brain is a diseased brain. And it is on this brain that we rely. The world of upbringing and education hasn't begun to make it clear to the infant from infancy onwards the place and meaning of the brain. Of course, you can't talk to an infant like this, but you know what I mean. One learns these things very painfully, very slowly, by oneself, because one finds oneself alone. The simple-minded religious runs to this teacher, to that teacher, because, again, we have images set up. Oh, so-and-so is a great yogi, so-and-so is a very holy man, so-and-so is a wonderful, has a wonderful gift for lucid exposition, and so forth and so forth. But can I go to somebody and let us assume that there is a real intelligent person, a really holy person, a person who has truly realized. Can I go to him, listen to him, and know truly what he is trying to convey in terms of concepts and words? This brain immediately interprets what he says in the limited way, the bedeviled way in which my own brain functions. I'm the prisoner of my own mental constructs. the presence of one who is free within his own soul, of one who has, to some extent at least, realized, the presence of that person exerts a healing, living force. That is the value of meeting somebody who is, as we say, more advanced. We know how easily, for instance, when we are students in school, and particularly at the university stage, we have a really lucid, great mind expounding, teaching. In his presence we understand the whole thing quite easily. When we have come away, I forgot that, you know, what did he say, etc., etc. I remember very well those 8 years when I went to Solomon for piano lessons, how in his presence, good gracious me, things, music would be just music, and it would be wonderful. Then when I came home and tried to practice and went for the next lesson, again he had to exert all his influence, psychical and with demonstration on the piano, how it ought to be, how it should go. Inspiration. And in terms of the religious life, you know the phrase I have used, spiritual induction. It's an induction, like electromagnetic induction. It takes place. And it's a magic. All creative activity, whatsoever comes to fruition, is pure magic. We don't know how it happens. Everything that exists in the universe as such is a miracle in itself. It's a marvel in itself. So now, we have to wake up to the fact that the brain is like that. Therefore, watch the reactions of the brain. And keep an open mind all the time. Open with respect to that which is what we, that which we commonly say is outside ourselves, as well as to that which is inside ourselves. If we keep a totally open mind, then we will be free of credulity and incredulity. We will be free of grasping something and saying, this is the fact, this is the truth, I'll keep it now. Or rejecting it and saying, this is not the fact, not the truth. Keep the mind open, and the truthfulness of reality will emerge, will not emerge, I use the word emerge, I should have said will emerge, immerge. The truthfulness of reality will emerge into your whole being and enlighten you. You see? The whole being gets filled with the truth, which, when it does that, becomes inexpressible. It is so great, it is so wonderful, so profound, so extraordinary, so total and complete, that it is inexpressible by the finite, limited mortal. But it transforms the finite, limited mortal, including his brain, into a pure instrument, an apparatus, through which the infinite can function and function freely. When that happens, the brain won't know that it is happening. If the brain unfortunately makes a concept about it and says any words about it, it darkens the light. It can't darken the light. It comes as a cloud between the light and oneself. So you see, look into all spiritual longings, religious longings, and see how they are just constructs of the brain, just ordinary verbal and conceptual constructs. And as such, they clutter the full and free activity of our awareness of reality. Now perhaps one may begin to see the meaning of emptying the mind. This emptiness that is spoken of in the teachings of the Upanishads and the Buddha and so forth, you see, and by all the great mystics, Christian, Sufi, Hindu, Buddhist, the whole lot. This emptying of the mind, this making the soul naked, stripping oneself completely. What does one strip oneself of? Selfness. And it is not a conscious stripping. It just happens. That which obstructs, that which is a dis-ease of one's being, just falls off by itself. And that energy, that living energy in our own being, which took these ill forms, is liberated into pure creative energy. And this creativeness, remember, is nothing that we can know about. We can never know it. It is there everlastingly, eternally. Eternally active. We no longer prevent it from functioning through us. The moment we form concepts that, I'll direct my creative energies now for the salvation of mankind, then once again I'm the devil. And a very foolish one indeed. Unable to learn. You see, the subtle way in which the I comes in. And it's always associated with longings. I want to do this. I want to serve God. God doesn't need me to serve Him at all. That is why none of us can band together and form a union of workers for God. The whole lot of us are kicked downstairs into the very warm place. One has to be able to laugh at oneself over it all. Because if one doesn't laugh, you know, one gets overwhelmed and says, oh my goodness, this is too much for me. I can't stand this. This is not my cup of tea. Drink water. So now we may understand something of the imperative necessity for this emptying. The phrase used is emptying of the mind. It is not the mind that is emptied. It's the brain that one sees into and fully understands. When one fully understands that the brain functions this way, that all our reactions and so forth are merely obstructions to the free functioning of pure mind, when we really see that, then in the immediate moment we cease to obstruct. The brain doesn't obstruct. It just is quiet. It is silent. It is merely the apparatus through which not only the material seeing takes place of objects of sight or hearing or touch or taste or whatever the event or whatever it may be, not only that aspect, but it sees. There is no word to use really. We have to use the words which apply only in the material world. It sees the transcendental fact, which means that it is at one with the universal creative process. And through that, there is the fruition of the individual. Then you become individually a benediction upon your whole environment, without lifting a finger, without saying a word even. But your very existence is like the sun sending out light and heat. Then religious living is actually present there.